This week, the impressive precious metals rebound continued with gusto. Silver blasted higher by over 13%, finishing above $23, while gold is attempting to break through $1,400 with its eyes set firmly on $1,500 an ounce. Welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. I'm your host, Chris Waltzek. In this August 16th broadcast, the show begins with the Market Weatherman Report and the latest economic news and trends affecting your portfolio. Next, I open up the listener mailbag to tackle all of your questions and comments. While gold and silver are still backward dated, in fact, silver is backdated on every single contract outstanding. JP Morgan insiders announced this week that the bottom is in place for the metals and investors still have time to buy the bounce. My guests seem to agree. Joining me with their take on the economy and the precious metals, Dr. Roger Tutterow, Dr. Stephen Lieb, and James Turk, who makes a startling discovery regarding gold backwardation on the London Exchange. James Turk says that in 2008 and the year 2000, at the lows, gold was backdated, marking the most important bottoms. Well, it just happened again in London, suggesting that the bear is in hibernation and the bulls will run for the rest of the year. Next, Dr. Stephen Lieb and I discuss the economy, as well as alternative energy sources. We have a quick primer on solar and wind power for those of our listeners who might be interested in lowering their monthly energy bills or just getting off of the grid. Dr. Roger Tutterow from Mercer University brings the runners across the plate with his economic insights. He, too, likes the precious metals prospects. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with a Market Weatherman Report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week. Investors added gold and silver to portfolios at a record clip on news of robust global demand for the metals. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal flew higher by nearly 70, finishing the trading session at $13.77. Silver outperformed the yellow metal, adding nearly $3, over 13% for the week, finishing at $23.26. Clearly, silver is benefiting from the theme of economic improvement in China, the U.S., as well as expectations that the Eurozone will slide out of the recession by the end of this year. Silver and gold are now simultaneously backdated, as I mentioned. Silver backwardation begins immediately following the cash contract beginning in September of this year, running all the way through July of 2018, much deeper than even last week, before the explosive move. Gold backwardation begins on December of 2014 and runs through June of 2019. This is also a solid sign, and it's on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Meanwhile, gold climbed to the highest point in nearly 2 months, and silver staged the best rally in 5 years as traders picked up discounted bullion amid strong physical demand. According to the World Gold Council, precious metals, bars, and coins are flying off the shelves last quarter, while jewelry usage was the highest since 2008, as consumers and investors alike use lower prices to accumulate even more of the metals. Plus, silver ETF holdings soared to a new all-time record over the last 6 weeks. Over 14 tons of silver were added to the iShares Silver Trust. Elsewhere, gold added nearly 5% this week, while silver picked up over 13%, but silver is now up 27% from the lows set just last month. In fact, one major media outlet proclaimed that silver is back in bull market territory. I would argue that, well, it never entered a bear market. Plus, gold regained about 17% so far from the lows, an astounding advance. Also, filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission last Wednesday showed that hedge fund titans John Paulson and George Soros lowered their holdings. JP Morgan analysts noted on Thursday that the market ignored the Paulson gold sales, indicating that the bottom is likely in place and that investors should buy the bounce. It's been said it's often darkest just before the dawn. Well, even diehard gold enthusiasts, billionaire John Paulson lowered his stake in the Spider Gold Trust, the biggest bullion ETF, by 53%, according to an SEC filing. He was the largest holder of the gold fund and appears to have sold near the lows. And I view this as a positive sign. I'm not the only one. JP Morgan analysts agree. He made his mark shorting the housing market with specialized credit default swaps from his friends at Goldman Sachs. Elsewhere, major gold seller Blanchard stated that the recent market pullback, demand never slowed. The company expects gold to continue to rally above $1,400 within a month and close at $1,500 this year. Well, I would note that gold appears capable of blasting through $1,400 as early as next week. In addition, the worse-than-anticipated housing starts figure was viewed as a plus for the metal since they tend to have a highly negative correlation, or that is, when housing falls, precious metals tend to rise. Bottom line, on gold and silver. Well, thanks to QE-friendly comments from the FOMC, the ECB, and the BOE meetings 2 weeks ago, as well as solid global economic numbers, the inflation theme appears to be returning. Investors are shunning bonds in favor of stocks first and commodities second, but given the huge equities run-up this year, it appears that a sea change into commodities is underway. For the rest of this report, plus all the stock picks and related forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, for the second week running, investors booked profits on the U.S. Stock Exchange. A disappointing housing starts figure sent investors to the exits. Housing is arguably the most important domestic sector, with jobs created in construction and real estate, as well as secondary sectors like furniture, manufacturing, and home improvement. By Friday's closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials gave back 344 points, over 2%, finishing at 15,081. The S&P 500 gave back 36 points, over 2%, finishing at 1655, while the NASDAQ fared best, dropping 1.5% off 57, ending the week at 3602. This week marked the worst week of the year for the Dow Jones Industrials Average, but the number is a bit misleading given the enormous advance of 2013. Meanwhile, according to a government report, home builders started 896,000 new homes in July. That's up from 846,000 in June, but much lower than expected. So analysts blame higher rates for capping the impressive housing recovery. The HGX, Philadelphia Housing Market Index, did break down a bit. However, buying overcame selling this week, which suggests that it's too early to call a head and shoulders breakdown on the sector. The impact of sluggish housing is likely to be felt throughout the economy, so investors will be watching the sector closely. Turning to interesting stocks, Transmontane Partners, ticker TLP, is a refining and terminaling company in Denver, Colorado, with operations throughout the Southwest. The technical trend is impressive as shares seem to be finding support. In addition, according to DCF analysis, the stock remains undervalued by almost 100%. However, one proviso here, shares would not make my Alpha Stocks newsletter list due to lackluster earnings. Still, as a turnaround candidate, the technical position is compelling. Shares appear poised to rebound from the 50-period moving average support level, suggesting an advance to a new high of 80 is possible, but until the stock market finds its footing, caution is advised. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, although fear is starting to creep back into the markets, as seen in our fear and greed sentiment indicator, levels have not yet reached extremes. I don't really see any reason to panic here, nor any reason to jump back into the market at this time. For the rest of this report and all the stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our guest Trifecta. So we want you to stay tuned here with us with more edutainment headed your way. Dr. Stephen Leeb has over a quarter century of investment experience and is author of 7 bestsellers, including his latest titled Red Alert. Welcome back, Dr. Stephen Leeb.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure being with you as always.
Great to have you back. And, you know, those of us who monitor the economy and markets all week have a tendency, I think, sometimes to overweigh the negative aspects. I thought that today maybe we would try to search for more positives if we can. And for instance, despite high unemployment, the stock market has continued to set new records seemingly every week here. We haven't seen an equities market, I think, this robust in about a decade. So I guess the question is this simply reallocation from bonds into stocks, or is there something bigger going on behind the scenes here, Dr. Leeb?
Well, I think, you know, to some extent, it definitely is reallocation from bonds to stocks. But it's important to realize that's informed or motivated by improvement in growth, not just in the U.S., where, you know, you see figures like unemployment insurance claims coming down, most of the data on housing remaining robust. sorted other numbers being pretty good. It's also informed, I think, by Europe. I mean, Europe finally, at long last, has made a apparent bottom. They had experienced six consecutive quarters of negative growth in Europe. I don't know when, you know, the biggest nation or the biggest economic bloc in the world has ever experienced six consecutive negative quarters of growth. But it was, it was tough. It was especially tough on the Europeans, and it still is very, very tough on the Europeans. But at least they're going in the right direction. And I don't think it's coincidental, Chris, that as Europe bottomed, what you saw was a bounce in commodities, and especially in some of the base commodities such as copper. Actually, silver, it's an industrial commodity as well as a monetary metal, and oil. Oil is also strong. Now, some of that could be due to the fact the world is not exactly a calm place when it comes to the Mideast, but it's still, I think, also due to, you know, recognition that growth is picking up. Now, I think the sleeper here, and really the elephant in the room, has been China. Everybody has been looking at China as a glass half filled, that their growth is going down. They've got a major transition to a fact from a country growing solely on the basis of investments and exports to one that wants to grow on the backs of their consumer class. That's a huge transition. And the press, I think, and, you know, people from Paul Krugman, you know, who's a brilliant economist, you may not agree with his politics, but, I mean, you can't take away the fact that he is an exceptionally good economist. And many others have argued that it's kaput for China. I think instead, you know, China's been doing remarkably well in the face of basically drying up of their export market. I mean, China was driven by exports. The economists have been right on that, but the fact that they've maintained strong growth in the face of, you know, a major driver going almost into reverse, I think has been remarkable. Now the fact that you see Europe gaining, and now you're seeing exports likely picking up in China, and you're also seeing signs that the Chinese economy is picking up, actually. Electricity demand surged. I think the year-over-year change was 8%, and the Chinese currency, the yuan, is at another all-time high. It's fixing last night. Its close last night was another all-time high. You know, with this, I think you're seeing a renaissance in the commodity patch. I don't think it was at all coincidental that commodities made some sort of top in 2011, almost to the core, certainly to the quarter, maybe to the week in which Europe started on its way down. And it appears that commodities have made some sort of bottom, almost coincident with indications that the European recession has finally ended. Europe is a very big deal in this world. I mean, again, it is the largest economic bloc. And its recovery, even if it's only slight, is going to have major feed-on effects, feedback to other economies, and in particular economies like China. And China, you know, is also engaged in a project called urbanization. And they plan to urbanize over the next 10, 12, 15 years about 250 million people. Now, you say that like it's just people say that like it's just a number. But it's a number that compares to saying, imagine that 80 or 90% of America is living in rural areas, not no cities around, and that we decide to urbanize 90% of our country. Can you imagine the demand for copper and everything else that would occur because of that? It's unbelievable. And so I think that, you know, looking forward, China actually has two major goals that will accomplish the same thing, that will lead to the same thing, a consumer much better fixed to continue to support the economy. In addition to their urbanization plans, they're also their energy plans. China is developing renewable energies as fast as they can. as fast as humanly possible. And that includes building smart, building out their smart grid. All these areas, from the smart, from smart grid to solar to wind to hydro, probably nuclear, they are leading the world by far. And I think they will continue to do so. Developing all renewable energies, alternative energies, et cetera, whatever you want to call it, is a very resource-intensive job. That's one of the things I wrote about in Red Alert. And it's going to need a lot of resources. And I think what you're seeing is, one of the reasons I think you're seeing this upturn in commodities is China's demand for these resources is picking up. And I think the markets are becoming less bearish on commodities. And it's sort of fitting together to a bottom in commodities. Now, what you've noticed very recently, Chris, is that today we got strong economic data, no doubt. Unemployment insurance claims at a six-year low. I mean, that's a very, very telling sign. And it's almost certain that the Fed will taper as a result. I mean, they'll cut back on, you know, how much money they're putting into the economy, you know, by bond buying. If you recall a month or two ago, news that the economy was soaring, or not soaring, that the economy was coming out of its doldrums, the Fed might taper, et cetera, was sending gold into a tailspin. Gold's not going into a tailspin now. Gold, as I look at it, as I talk to you right now, is down about a dollar. I mean, a fraction of 1%, about a tenth of 1%. And the market is down about 1.3%. Gold is starting to react to the old, to what it should react to, not prospects of, you know, further easing, but rather prospects of a turn in commodities. And what's very important here is that eventually some of these commodities, whether it be silver, copper, or other things, water in particular too, are going to become scarce. And when commodities become scarce, people, countries, individuals, whoever owns those scarce commodities, don't want to trade them for paper money. They want to trade them for something more tangible. And that more and most likely more tangible commodity for which they would trade a scarce commodity, valuable commodity, would be gold. It's been around for, I don't know, millennia. And silver. So it's not an accident that you're starting to see gold and especially silver push up. Silver is getting a dual boost right now because not only is it a monetary metal, but it's also an industrial metal. And it's also vital in Chinese plans to create a renewable energy infrastructure because solar energy does require silver. Japan also is going to need a lot of silver for their photovoltaics because they're basically going to replace a huge chunk of nuclear with solar. And, you know, and so it goes. So I think that the argument for commodities in general has become, you know, much, much stronger thanks to, you know, Europe and the feedback effects that it has on countries, especially China, thanks to the fact that China does appear to be turning. And, you know, and thanks to the fact that I guess I should also include that the nearsightedness of the West in putting on hold and putting on hold the plans to develop new sources, new iron ore mines, new copper mines, etc. You know, when copper was down, everybody cut back from BHP to, you know, you name it. They basically, you know, reduce their capital expenditures. So, you know, right now you're in a situation where the rubber's likely to hit the road as far as the commodity patch goes, in which you have not as much supply as you should, if it's even available, because as commodity prices go up, you know, it affects all commodities and the costs of commodities. And, you know, one reason there were so many cutbacks in capital expenditures is that things, capital, building mines and infrastructure becomes so expensive. So this rise in commodities, I think, is a it's going to feed on itself for a while. Now, how does that fit into the stock market? Temporarily, it's good news. it means that we have growth, and the stock market, I think, is absolutely right to be responding to economic growth. But there will come a point where we have too much of a good thing. Historically, whenever, let's say, a commodity like oil has jumped sharply in a fairly sharp short period of time, it's been big trouble ahead. I mean, you just need to think back to 2008 when you had that huge jump and spike in oil prices, and that was followed by a massive recession, et cetera. Almost every, I think every recession that we've had since the early 70s is a point that I've been making for about the last 10 years, and nothing has changed. I mean, I could have made it, you know, it applied to 2008. Every recession that we've had in this economy since the early 70s has been preceded by a huge spike in oil prices. And I don't think any recession has come about without a huge spike in oil prices. So no big spike in oil prices right now, no big spike in commodity prices, but you're certainly laying the foundation for what could be, you know, the end of what we're seeing. So right now, I guess my advice to investors would be a little bit more emphasis on that commodity patch. I mean, for the contrarians, John Paulson sort of gave up on his gold bet, or at least halfway gave up on it, and sold half his GLD position. And George Soros, I think, got out of his GLD position, and, you know, so have a lot of other people. So the sentiment feels right, the conditions feel right. I think that you're just going to see continued gains in commodities and continued gains in stocks until the gains in commodities go too far. That's how I see the world.
You talked about the importance of renewable energy in China as well as in Asia, and I think this is going to be critical for the precious metals going forward. For instance, I don't know how many people are aware of just how much silver goes into making a solar cell, as much as 1 ounce of silver. And of course, the production costs on these are very low. I mean, retail, it's getting close to $1 per watt. The typical 100 watt solar panel on a roof we have right here at the studio, about 1,000 watts or a kilowatt per hour. We're trying to get the entire office and studio completely off grid. And so you could be talking as much as 10 ounces of silver, and it's very difficult to reclaim once it's been put into solder and into these circuits. And you're right, the trend towards solar is a very powerful one, and it just requires huge amounts of silver that will not, you know, re-enter the system. So, as you say, China and Japan both leading the charge in Asia as far as solar is concerned, and wind power to wind turbine power as well. We actually have a wind turbine here. It's a kind of a hobby, and it lower our carbon footprint as much as possible. Kind of a passion, because we're already into electronics, you can imagine, with radio and recording and whatnot. But, you know, 4 deep cycle batteries, the grid tie inverter, the regular inverters, of course, to run the backup. So we're just in the beginning phases here. It's interesting because direct current is so much different from alternating current. It requires different circuits, circuit breakers, lightning arresters, grounding. You know, the grounding has to be done very carefully with very thick wire. The type of energy output will just fry and actually set on fire. I've actually seen in my own eyes a DC surge go through an AC breaker and smoke it and set it on fire. The arc was remarkable, even though it wasn't a very powerful DC surge. But the breakthroughs in just the past few years in this sector are absolutely remarkable. For instance, you can get for a very low price a lightning arrester, which will absorb as much as 115,000 amps of lightning, yeah, in the system. The technology today, I think, is now available for just individuals and small businesses to run off-grid. It's affordable, whereas 30, 40 years ago, when I first got interested, you know, in the late 70s in solar, it was really more within the realms of very wealthy folks or people who had no other alternative, you know, for solar. But the thought today that, you know, one could run a homestead or a small cabin or condos off grid. Now, if you're in a really windy area, wind power, but I greatly prefer solar, even though we live in a wooded area here, simply because of the steadiness of solar. You know, solar power, as soon as the sun is up, it's producing amazing energy, and then you peak out, you know, in the afternoons, but it continues to produce well after 8 p.m. at night. I think it's just probably one of the neatest hobbies of all. And did I even mention the federal government gives you roughly a 30 to 35% tax break, tax return, and then the state government here in North Carolina is one of the best. So it's roughly a 62 to 65% tax break on every panel and device that you purchase. That's nearly two-thirds of your cost is covered in tax breaks. You add the silver into the silver panels, you add the tax breaks, you add the fact that you're lowering your carbon footprint, so you have that green benefit as well, and then it's a business that starts producing for you early in the morning every day, requires very little maintenance, whereas, you know, a greenhouse or a farm requires daily constant maintenance. I think it's probably one of the neatest and most common sense hobbies that every American should just start to dabble in.
You know, Americans aren't. You know, unfortunately, America is, quoting Jeremy Grantham, I may have mentioned this before, but he did an opinion piece in Nature. And, you know, his comments were not in so many words, but very, very direct in terms of how influential the oil industry is in Congress. He said they basically own it. And we really haven't gone head over heels on any of these renewable energies. And I'm not even sure we have the resources to. I mean, I don't think we have enough silver, for one thing, and we certainly don't have anywhere near enough of the heavy rare earths to really make a dent in our energy situation regarding wind. China, on the other hand, basically controls the heavy rare earth market, and they are, you know, accumulating silver and they're accumulating gold, et cetera, you know, are just in a much, much better position than we are. You know, and it's worth mentioning, too, that it's not for lack of being aware. I mean, you know, Chris, you're obviously aware. You're a very astute and knowledgeable guy, and you've been involved in this for a long time. And there are other people that are aware. Warren Buffett. I mean, I was surprised to find out that MidAmerican, the utility that he owns, is the largest dedicated utility, I mean, you know, focused in one area of the world, their consumption, their renewable energy footprint, their is larger than any other utility. That's Buffett. He gets it, yeah. But we don't as a country. And, you know, we are doing, you know, I just think, you know, lip service more than anything else to really getting this thing out there, getting all renewables out there. I mean, our focus has been on fracking, and this is just not a ticket to anything other than using up a lot of water, using up a lot of precious resources, and, you know, in the end, ending up with a boondoggle, you know, just another... you know, just another failed effort, and I don't know how much room we have for failed efforts in this country. And I'm really getting worried. I think we have to sort of come together before it's too late.
Last week with Charles Goyette on this topic, we were talking about how, you know, what if we were focusing our efforts on, instead of becoming this giant global police state?
Oh, you're absolutely right. This, you know, I politically, I mean, I'll confess, I used to call myself a liberal Democrat. I don't anymore. I call myself an American. And, you know, I think that people have to take ideas from wherever they can. And, you know, the civil libertarians, I think, have a great point about this. I mean, you know, let's stop spending so much money overseas with this and that and everything else. I mean, look what happened. Look what's going on in Egypt now. You know, how much did we help there? Really, give me a break. You know, we've got to focus. I mean, the best form of the best defense is a strong offense, and in this case, a strong offense is a energy infrastructure that is going to serve us well, and we don't have it. We're nowhere close.
I was very pleased to find out that my government was actually so supportive at the federal and the state level in an economical sense because, you know, these things become expensive quickly. We've learned here firsthand in this area, wind turbine, for instance, power is maybe not the best idea. Now, if you lived in the Midwest somewhere or you're near the beach, or you live in maybe Colorado, if you're in one of these areas that has a steady, constant wind, of course, wind turbine would probably surpass your solar production. When I started to get involved in this, I didn't realize it can produce so much power that you actually have to have a what's called a load reducer. Some people call it a load dump, an energy dump, what have you, because it can overwhelm your charge controllers. It can overwhelm your inverters, your grid tie inverters. It can actually fry the entire system. You have to actually have something that you can divert it to. And one suggestion I have to anyone out here who's sort of interested in this hobby is to direct your load, if you have wind, into a grid tie inverter. And we haven't talked about this. This, I think, is perhaps the greatest breakthrough in solar and wind power production in probably the last 50 years. I think it even surpasses the affordability of solar power. And that's called the grid tie. For folks who don't know, it simply means that whatever power that you're producing goes into this tiny device, very inexpensive device. You can get them for $50. And you start pumping that directly. You plug it into the wall like you'd plug a light, just a three-prong right into the wall, and immediately you can start spinning, and I kid you not, your meter outside can spin backwards, assuming you don't have one of the smart meters yet, which most people don't have yet, a digital meter. Now, here's the interesting thing. These grid tie inverters, as I mentioned, are very inexpensive. You can have a 1,000-watt grid tie inverter, for instance, for just a couple hundred dollars, producing 20 of those light bulbs, you know, the fluorescent light bulbs that are so powerful now, these 23 and 26 watt light bulbs that are as bright or brighter than a 100-watt light bulb. They last seemingly for years instead of burning out all the time, and they use 1/4 the wattage that a normal incandescent light would use.
But I think what you say is just terrific, and I am so glad to hear people like you so enthusiastically endorsing and promoting renewable energies, because not only are you doing yourself a favor, you're doing everybody else.
I really got off topic there for a moment.
No, that's great. No, if you're going to get off topic on anything at all, this is the thing to get off topic on, because this is a great, great point. Great point. It's thrilling to hear somebody that knows as much as you do, because it shows that there's hope for us, that there are people that get involved and yes, it makes me feel very, very good inside. It makes me feel good for my kids. Makes me feel good. I mean, talking to you makes me feel very, very good. It really does, to hear people, you know, so involved.
I mean, you've been a big proponent here on the show of photovoltaics over the years.
Yes, I have, and I'm very happy. I think you've obviously been involved longer than I have.
I mean, I've always been interested in it, but what I didn't know was that the government virtually pays for it, so it takes away from your tax bill, and just what an amazingly efficient and economical hobby.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, I think there's a place for nuclear, and I think that it's not going to answer the prayers of, or it's not going to be the basis or the foundation of the next energy infrastructure.
Let me close on one topic here, because I know your time is brief and we appreciate it today, but you brought up two very interesting points, one of them being the trouble in the Eurozone as a primary contributing factor to the sluggishness in the past 6 to 12 months.
Commodities across the board, and really it's been about 18 months, yes.
Almost 12 months ago, the euro in terms of gold and silver, but particularly with gold, broke down for the first time that I've been able to find over the last 12-year bull market in gold. And interestingly, I just wanted to throw this anecdote out there, that it has put in a remarkable double bottom in the weekly chart and is very technically strong here, the euro, once again, in terms of gold, which seemed to coincide with the entire 12-year bull market in gold.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Europe's a big deal. I mean, people forget about how important Europe is. It is a bigger economic sector than the U.S., bigger economic block than the U.S. So anything that happens in Europe is a very, very big deal, very big deal.
So as we wrap up here with stronger growth in China, as you mentioned, of course.
I was going to say, gather those rosebuds while you may. This is a very good time for, you know, I think stocks and especially commodities.
Exactly. And so the precious metals, then you would certainly, I'm sure, be directing.
I would own them. Yes, absolutely.
Is there any contact information you'd like to share today?
I guess you can just go to leib.com. That will get you to everything.
Very good. And they can always pick up a copy of any of your books, I'm sure, at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com.
Amazon.com has them all.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time, and we'll look forward to your return to GoldSeek.com.
I do too, Chris. It's always wonderful talking to you, and keep up the great work. Thank you very, very much.
As trust in paper money continues to wane, investors are demanding the return of their gold. But how much is left in major vaults? My next guest says the gold stockpiles at key central banks and the New York Commodities Exchange may be nearly depleted. It's a pleasure to welcome back today's featured guest, James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Let's start off with backwardation. You know, as of last Friday, we saw gold backwardation and silver backwardation. Gold started in May of 2014. It ran all the way to the latest contract, the furthest contract, July of 2018. That was silver backwardation. With gold, we had backwardation beginning in June of 2014, running all the way through 2019. That's one of the first times I ever recall such deep backwardation in both contracts, simultaneously at least. Can you outline why you view this as a positive development?
Yeah, we have to sort of distinguish between silver and gold when it comes to backwardation. And the reason is that there are basically two types of backwardation. There's backwardation that occurs in a commodity because of different grades or shortages in any one given location or transport bottlenecks or things like that. And then there's backwardation that occurs in money. And the backwardation that occurs in money is dependent upon risk and the interest rates at which that money can be borrowed and sold. And, you know, gold is a money backwardation principally, although it does have some commodity elements to it. And silver, as a substitute for gold, in my view, also has a monetary aspect to it, but it's much more heavily influenced by commodity backwardation type issues because there just isn't the same above ground stock of silver as there is in terms of gold. In other words, relatively speaking, the above ground stock of silver is much smaller than the above ground stock of gold. But yeah, you know, let's look at gold first, Chris, because that's really, I think, the more important one. What we are seeing now is basically totally unprecedented. Gold has an interest rate at which it can be borrowed and sold. It's not politically correct since 1971 to call it money or to call it an interest rate. But, you know, gold's been money for 5,000 years, and it's not going to change just because some government or central banks, you know, say it's been demonetized. It still acts like money. It just doesn't circulate as currency unless you're in places like Turkey or Vietnam where, you know, gold still does actively circulate. But basically, you know, gold is money. It has an interest rate. And the key here is it's always the lowest interest rate of any form of money. And the reason why gold always has the lowest interest rate is basically because it does not have two risks inherent in all national currencies. The first risk is that there's the risk of debasement. You know, national currencies can be printed to unlimited quantities, you can't do that with gold. Gold only comes from, you know, the process of mining and pulling that asset out of the ground, which leads to the second risk that you have in currencies that you don't have in gold. Gold is a tangible asset, and it doesn't have counterparty risk. National currencies are based on someone's promise, you know, be it a bank, a central bank, a government, or whatever. And, you know, those promises can be broken, but, a gold coin or gold bar in your hand, that's a real thing. So you don't have counterparty risk with gold. So gold interest rates are always lower than other currencies' interest rates. And then it becomes just a question of mathematics in calculating forward rates. Because gold always has the lowest interest rate, it's always going to be in contango, meaning futures prices are always going to be higher than in those other currencies. Here we are in a situation, though, that for 28 days, according to the LBMA data recorded on its website, gold is in backwardation. against the U.S. dollar. It's unprecedented. I've never seen anything like this before, but the bottom line is it's very bullish.
So you don't follow, then, the New York COMEX exchange?
And I do that for a reason, Chris. It's that in terms of the world of gold, you have to remember that there are two different gold markets. There's the physical gold market, and then there's the paper gold market. And the paper gold market is huge in its own right, but the COMEX is just a small part of the paper gold market. And even though the paper gold market in London is much larger than the COMEX as well. So I really follow the London market because that's really the most significant in terms of how prices are set or discovered or traded, however you want to describe that, in terms of both the physical gold market and the paper gold market.
When we start to talk about gold backwardation, to put it very simply here, apparently gold should be more expensive in the future. You talked about why it has such a low interest rate, and that's because it has very little counterparty risk. And that just makes common sense. I mean, an item or a security which carries lower risk should have a lower interest rate because you're expected to pay a higher interest rate for greater risk and vice versa. Then we come to the current situation where gold actually is less expensive in the future. And tell folks why you think this is significant and what it may portend for the metal, please.
Yeah, first of all, in theory, it can't happen for the reasons we just discussed. It should be arbitraged away. In other words, if you have physical metal today, you can benefit in three ways by selling that physical metal today. And the ways you benefit is you sell it today and you buy a contract 1 or 3 months forward at a cheaper price. So you're selling metal at a higher price and buying it at a cheaper price. Secondly, you're avoiding storage costs for this, let's say, the 3 months while you've sold today and you don't get the metal back until 3 months in the future. You're avoiding the storage costs of holding that metal. And thirdly, by selling today, you get the proceeds of the U.S. dollar that you have for 3 months until you have to pay the dollars to get your metal at some future price. So the fact that gold is not being arbitraged today is very significant. It's giving us an important message. The message is that people would rather own physical gold than take that profit opportunity. What that's essentially saying is that people are exiting paper and moving into physical. Now, the fact that this has lasted as long as it has is really sort of mind-boggling. Like I said, it's 28 days since the 8th of July when it's been reported as backward on the LBMA website. But this, and there's no saying how much longer it's going to go, but what it's basically saying is that gold is too cheap down here at these prices. And, everything comes down to supply and demand, Chris, as we all know. The demand for gold is very, very strong. But the supply of gold only comes from two sources. It comes from new mine production or the existing above-ground stock of gold. So what has to happen in order to bring the physical market back into balance is the price has to rise because the mines can't all of a sudden produce a huge amount of gold. The mining constrains how much they can produce in every year, which is about 1.8% of the total above-ground stock of gold year after year after year. It's just consistent in terms of the way that works out because of the way gold's dispersed in the Earth's crust. So if you can't get a lot of new gold to satisfy supply at current prices from the mining companies, you have to get it from the existing above-ground stock. And the only way to get it from the existing above-ground stock is for the gold price to rise high enough to entice people who own physical metal today to sell it and take and hold dollars instead. And we have seen backwardation in gold twice before, and since this bull market began, Chris. Once was back in 1999. It lasted for a few days. The second time was 2008. It lasted for a few days that time as well. Now, those two dates are significant because from the low in 1999, it was marked by backwardation, and we had a huge move up in the gold price. In 2008, the low in the gold price was marked by backwardation, and we had a huge move up. I mean, within 12 months, gold moved from that low in 2008, and within 12 months made a new record high over $1,000 an ounce. Now, today, we're at a low price in gold, and and it's being marked by backwardation. And my expectation is that, you know, we're going to repeat what happened in 1999 and in 2008. But because this backwardation has been bigger and deeper and more prolonged, maybe this is even going to be more spectacular over the next 12 months than it was in 1999 or in 2008. You know, only time will tell because we can't predict the future. But, you know, everything is suggesting that, you know, gold is way too cheap down here. In fact, you know, the backwardation started when gold was at $1,200 an ounce. Here we're at $1,335, $135 higher, and gold's still in backwardation. It's truly remarkable, Chris. It really is.
I think those are very significant points. 2008 and 1999, a simple glance at a weekly or monthly chart, and they certainly were the two most significant lows in the last 30 years.
I agree. And, you know, a few years from now, when we look back at 2013 and gold prices today, I think you're going to have the same kind of conclusion that this was a significant low.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. And another scenario that I've been throwing around here for a while that also, I think, backs up the bullish thesis with backwardation. Is it possible that the miners are selling forward such a heavy amount due to fear of their supply and future supply that they're actually pushing down the future prices forward a tremendous amount? And could that be a sign of extreme fear and capitulation in the market?
Well, I think that's is one of the excuses by the apologists of paper money. But the reality is that arbitrage opportunity exists. Why aren't people selling physical spot metal and buying it back 3 months or, you know, forward and taking the profit, avoiding the storage costs, and earning, having the opportunity to hold the proceeds and do something with those dollars for 3 months until they buy their metal in 3 months' time at a cheaper price? As long as that arbitrage opportunity exists, regardless what the apologists for paper monies might say, something is fundamentally wrong, and what's fundamentally wrong is the gold price is too cheap at these levels.
And what do you say about folks who claim this could also be a component of lack of faith or lost faith in the ability for the exchanges to make good on their promises to deliver gold and silver, physical gold and silver and bullion in the future?
You know, the COMEX stocks have been drawn down, and there's a lot more paper than there is COMEX stocks if everybody who owned paper futures contracts wanted to take delivery. But it's very difficult to actually take delivery through the COMEX. You know, they want to keep the stocks there to, you know, give the pretense that it's available for anybody who wants to take delivery of it. Nevertheless, the COMEX stocks have been drawn down. The LBMA, the London Bullion Market Association, is not really an exchange. It's just an association of market makers. The trading over there is done over the counter. It's not in any kind of real, you know, regulated market like the COMEX is. So there, it wouldn't be a market default per se. It would be just a default of one or more banks who fail to deliver on their commitment to deliver metal under, you know, some kind of contract that they have with their various customers. It's hard to say, you know, how this is going to play itself out, other than the fact that they expect the gold price to rise. You know, there may be some defaults, but, you know, regardless, that's not the key issue. The key issue is that the gold price is too cheap down here at these levels, and the interest rate structure of money around the world has to come back to a more normal level, which means that gold has to have the lowest interest rate, and we have to start seeing gold in contango against the U.S. dollar.
You know, another interesting aspect of this story is the discrepancy or ambiguities that seem to be appearing between the East and the West. And for instance, we look at the Shanghai Gold Exchange, the premiums there that we're seeing over the London price. This has been extreme during the past few months at some points. It's still relatively high, much higher than that $5 to $6 that we typically saw. And Mike Maloney penned an interesting article recently noting that although the Shanghai Exchange may be more than tenfold smaller than the COMEX Exchange, it delivers up to 9 times more gold than any other exchange in the world. And I just think there must be an interesting tie here between the premiums that they're experiencing there and the fact that they actually deliver an enormous amount of gold. Any comment?
Yeah, the fact that there is this huge premium in China, particularly, but also elsewhere in Asia, you know, reflects a couple of things. It itself is basically an indication that gold is in backwardation when you see a huge premium like that over other parts of the world. But, you know, this trend has been underway for quite some time, where metal is being shipped from the West to the East. It's being shipped from the West, where, you know, gold is largely misunderstood or not appreciated, to the East, where it is clearly understood and is recognized that gold is undervalued. And they can't get the gold fast enough at these prices, which is causing these huge premiums over there in Asia. This is something my colleague at Gold Money, Alistair McLeod, has been writing about for quite some time. He recently discovered that, you know, there's a possibility that the Bank of England has actually deshoarded 1,300 tons of metal over the past 6 months, which basically indicates that the demand that we saw going into Shanghai and other places, which was being recorded in terms of real physical metal, was coming, you know, out of the Bank of England, was coming out of the West, was coming from central banks who were using their gold reserves for, you know, whatever purpose. Maybe it was Italy selling to raise dollars or euros to help provide some liquidity to Italian banks, or it could have been the Spanish government, you know, who's running the similar type of issue that Italy is running in terms of, you know, bad banking problems. We just don't know. We'll find out, you know, after the fact. But we saw that gold going to Asia, and we'll learn eventually, you know, exactly where that gold came from.
You know, I wanted to ask you a bit about the FOMC meeting and Ben Bernanke's apparent about-face. He certainly scared or frightened investors for some time that they would remove the liquidity punch bowl from the market or exchange floors, and apparently that was, once again, just smoke and mirrors. I mean, I think most of us at the end of the day in this sector realize that if the central banks, including the ECB, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, Bank of China, if they truly did stop with their liquidity spending and stimulus efforts, we would certainly see a huge drop in productivity and a spike in unemployment and probably plunge into perhaps the deepest recession in memory. Do you have any thoughts on the taper talk and how that will affect the markets going forward?
It's basically that talk, you know, tapering. You know, the Fed is still out there buying $80 billion a month of paper. And the reality is that they're going to continue to talk about it, but they're not going to stop because they can't. And the reason why they can't, aside from, you know, the impact on the economy, is the fact that the U.S. government is still running these huge deficits. And who's going to buy all of this paper if the Fed's not there willing to pick it up? So, yeah, they'll talk, you know, up a storm, but, you know, just follow what they do. They're going to continue to, you know, buy that paper. And, you know, follow what the markets are telling us. You know, the gold has been in an uptrend now for several weeks since that low of $1,200 back in, I guess it was June. And, you know, here we are at 1335. Look what silver's done, you know, from 18-something to almost $22 as we speak here today. You know, the markets are giving us a message. The U.S. 10-year note is 2.71%. That's up from, I can't even remember what it was, under 2%, you know, back in May. So even though the Fed's out there buying paper, interest rates are rising. The Fed is losing control. And I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing this huge demand into physical metal and out of paper. You know, people are taking a cautious, prudent step here, converting out of paper, gold, paper, everything, and buying physical metal. And as a consequence, you're seeing this backwardation lasting for an unprecedented period of time in the gold market.
You know, the COT chart, clearly one of the most bullish I've seen in years, and can't help but notice that the institutions seem to have covered most of their short positions and are virtually flat for about 2 months. Although it's not an excellent timing indicator, it's one of those sentiment measures or metrics that I like to look at, and it seems to indicate that, of course, the institutions tend to be correct, and then the small speculators as well, who tend to be incorrect, have tossed in the towel. It seems like the risk for the correction has certainly passed when we see these numbers, and the real risk is missing an explosive recovery rally. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The COT report, the COT report, is basically showing that, you know, the banks, the institutions, you know, the knowledgeable players in the market are ready for a big move up in the gold market. The weak hands here are the hedge funds who were piling on and piling on in the spring and going into the early summer. And, you know, they're now caught, and that could create an explosive rally. In fact, you know, we've already seen a little bit of it over the past week or so. I mean, look what silver's been doing. I think breaking out of its base. So, you know, who knows what's possible here over the next several weeks.
One of the components is the amazing rally we've seen in copper. There's a huge industrial component to copper. And with China now, a huge GDP boost there, plus import and export explosion, well above expectations. I think one of the big components to the copper and then the silver rally is unexpectedly strong and robust growth in China and in Asia, not to mention around the world. Industrial applications for silver probably helping it to rebound from unbelievably oversold levels. Anything that we haven't covered today?
No, I think we've covered it all. You know, Chris, and, you know, of course, if people are interested in buying some physical metal, goldmoney.com, my company, is always there to help you. You know, not only is the is it economical, you know, to buy physical metal through Gold Money, we also offer storage in different vaults around the world. And the vaults that we're offering in Hong Kong and in Singapore, where we have two different companies offering two different sets of vaults in both of those cities, have become increasingly popular of late.
Very good. Well, thanks again for an excellent discussion and continued success.
Thank you very much, Chris. Look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Dr. Roger Tutterow, a professor of economics at Mercer University with a passion for economic modeling and forecasting. Welcome back, Dr. Tutterow.
Always great to be with you, Chris.
Well, let's begin today with your last appearance on the show. In August of last year, you predicted that the housing market would continue to improve. Over that period, the market gained over 75%, and from peak to trough, you're talking about nearly a 100% move there in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index anyway. Housing is arguably one of the most important components of our domestic economy. However, since May of this year, price is starting to sag a bit. The new housing starts are pointing downward. What are your models telling you with regard to the sector?
Well, with housing, I think it's important to, you know, keep in perspective how far down we dropped. In terms of the new home construction, nearly 80% from peak to trough. So we're going to see some big percentage changes over the next couple of years, including in 2012, which simply is an artifact of coming off such a low base. That having been said, it is clear that in almost every market around the nation, housing starts are up, home sales are up, home prices have been rising. The Case-Shiller Index is showing gains in almost all markets. And in many cases, those are strong double-digit gains. So I think we need to celebrate the positive there. I do think that in some areas, though, we've got to be a little careful. New home construction has benefited over the past 2 years from the ability of builders to purchase lots very, very cheap, in many cases from failed financial institutions. And so as long as you can get the land cheap enough, the lots are cheap enough, then you can add structure and compete with existing homes. But if we start seeing lot inventories get brought down and land prices rising, kind of the economics of the construction could become challenged at some point.
I wanted to move on now to the taper talk we've been hearing from the Fed. You know, Richard Fisher, he's a president of the Dallas Fed, said last week that investors should not count on the Fed to continue its $85 billion monthly bond purchases indefinitely. You know, I'd like your thoughts on the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's apparent change of heart regarding tapering the QE stimulus. Investors had expected the Fed to reduce monthly purchases of their toxic mortgage-backed securities and treasuries from around that $85 billion total to about $65 billion, especially given the lowest unemployment rate in over 5 years. Still, you know, 7.4%, it's well above the Fed's target, 6.5%. When do you expect a more hawkish Fed to emerge, and what do you think that would mean for the economy?
Well, at this point, it's unclear that we will get a hawkish Fed during the balance of Chairman Bernanke's term. I think Ben Bernanke did a very strong job during the darkest days of the financial crisis, and we need to acknowledge that. That having been said, I think at some point we've got to understand that there's limits to what the central bank can do in terms of continuing to support the economy. The real side of the economy has got to kind of show its ability to continue on its own legs, and I hope that we will move into kind of a tapering mode sooner rather than later. I don't think you can make the case that having long-term interest rates come up 100 basis points as they have by itself is to slow economic growth. I think that fundamentally the economy is working its way out of this downturn. The good news is the unemployment rate is down now below 7.5. We're making progress toward the Fed's presumptive goal of 6.5. We're not there yet. We're unlikely to get there over the next 6 to 9 months, but I wouldn't rule out reaching that point sometime in 2014 if economic growth remains sustained.
Very good. Well, speaking of rates, you know, given the more than $250 trillion in notional value of interest rate sensitive derivatives globally, do you expect another 2008-like deflation at some point? I mean, could we get caught in a deflationary spiral as these rates start to ratchet up higher? Many of those interest rate sensitive derivatives will begin to unwind.
Interest rate risk is very real. It's out there in the derivatives market, and quite candidly, the financial institutions need to keep an eye on it as well, because not only are financial institutions in many cases carrying some pretty significant securities portfolios, but as we start to see interest rates come up, there will be loans that start repricing at higher rates. Most of the loans are tied to the shorter end of the yield curve, and I don't expect the Fed to start raising short-term rates for another, at least another 12 months. But at some point, we will start to see borrowing costs come back up, and it will be not just the securities but also the loans that will be repriced at that time. So there are some areas out there that we will have to keep an eye on. I would say in the banking sector, interest rate risk has replaced credit risk in terms of what is dominating many analysts' minds at this time.
You talked about maybe 12 months before seeing the Fed or the FOMC ratchet up rates. But under this scenario, what if, for instance, we saw unemployment remain a bit more stubborn, if you will, and let's say we stay well above the 7% area and maybe even inch up a bit higher over the next 12 months? Would that change your outlook on the Fed's interest rate policy?
I think the Fed's been pretty clear about tying their what they call historically low rates to a 6.5% unemployment rate. And one of the things I've been glad about was in early 2012, they were tying the rates to a date on the calendar. And I thought that was a mistake. We need to have a central bank that is data dependent, that ties its policy to economic performance. And so if, in fact, the economy slows, if, in fact, the unemployment rate starts to move up again, then that, of course, would put any kind of tapering any kind of move in the policy rates on the back burner again. I don't think that there's going to be any appetite at the Fed for raising rates unless it's clear that the economy is firing on all cylinders and the labor markets are starting to tighten.
Well, you know, the threat of higher rates and slower global growth caused many investors to shun the precious metals in 2013. However, a recent report showed very unexpectedly strong growth from China, as well as around the world, but China was sort of the star last week. This could lead to some inflation fears, or at least a sea change in perspective with regard to inflation and, you know, by proxy, the commodities market. China's exports, you may have read, surged over 5% in July. Imports soared about 11% in July. We heard from the ECB, the Bank of England last week, as well as the Fed, and there are very few signs of halting any stimulus measures and not a lot of guidance, you might say, around the world. On paper, this sounds a bit more inflationary than deflationary. Could we see a resurgence in the price of the precious metals given this environment?
Well, it's possible. And I mean, when we think about metals prices, we understand that there are both real drivers there. And typically what we see is when the economy does grow faster, the demand for many commodities goes up. And so we tend to see some upward pressure on commodity prices if we have sustained stronger growth. The other part of the metals market is, of course, a very accommodative monetary policy tends to correlate sometimes with rising costs of metals and other commodities. And of course, some people have used gold over years as kind of of a barometer or hedge against inflationary pressures. In China's case, we're still talking about an economy that is growing at or below 7%, which, you know, while that would be robust for Western economies, is somewhat pedestrian, you know, compared to what they got used to in the preceding decade. So it'll be interesting to watch. The gold market appears to have pulled back and may have bottomed out, and of late maybe moving up a little bit higher. But again, with gold, it's complicated because you've got real factors that influence the demand. The presumption by investors that gold is a hedge against uncertainty and against inflation. And so all those things can interact to give you a lot of volatility in the short run.
Trim Tabs announced that stock funds experienced inflows of about $40 billion last month. Bonds, though, losing by a steady clip here, lost $21 billion following June's record $70 billion plunge in outflows from mostly mutual funds, but, you know, related ETFs in the sector. Clearly, investors seem to be reallocating funds away from interest-sensitive bonds and into stocks. Do you expect this trend to persist?
Well, you know, one of the arguments behind quantitative easing was that by pushing down long-term interest rates, it would encourage investors to move into riskier assets, including the equity class. But I think as of late, what's been happening is we've re-educated investors to understand that interest rates can move up. Over the past really 30-year bull market, we've seen them generally tracking downward. And I think that there is some recognition out of investors that we have seen the bottom for longer-term interest rates and for the cycle, perhaps, and that they don't want to be the last one out the door if, in fact, rates start rising. And then on the street, there are definitely some traders who play the Fed, and they try to get ahead of the Fed in terms of some policy moves. And that also, I think, has played into the recent movements.
Very good. As this discussion winds down today, anything that you're watching closely on the radar screen that you think that our listeners might be interested in today?
We started the discussion with housing, and I think that's still something very important. And the reason is, if you think about where a lot of the wealth in the household sector is concentrated, it was in the equity they had in their homes. And if you look at the data, what it shows is that we lost more than 50%, you know, closer to 60% of the equity that we had in the household sector between 2006 and 2012. If we're going to have robust economic growth and have consumers that are fully back on board, they're going to have to get the value of the equity they have in their houses back up closer to where it was prior to the recession.
Well, we want to thank you today for your time and wish you continued success, Dr. Roger Tutterow.
Chris, it's always great to be with you.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. For the past 2.5 years, I have not watched cable or satellite television in my house and have savored the distraction-free and highly productive living environment that creates. A high-speed internet connection gets me all the news I need from sources I deem to be reliable. Occasionally, though, there are days when I feel like turning off my modem, because more and more lockstep, talking point, sanitized, perception management, cookie-cutter news stories come across my computer screen, posing as what's supposed to be real news. I'd like to track down who really writes and ultimately authorizes the synchronized headline writing that attempts to manage our perception of economic reality by structuring headlines with implications that just aren't true, and create a frame of reference from imaginary third-party validation sources who, if they do exist, are skewing reality into what those reporting, or should I say, creating the news, want us to believe. How many times have you read or heard headlines that say, prices rise less than expected. Less than expected are three words that are designed to bypass your critical awareness and accept the supposed good news contained in the article or report without conscious analysis. Less than expected implies the report as being somewhat critical, and therefore the information being presented must be objective and accurate. Sometimes it is, but that phrase, when used in conjunction with media spin, is a device for getting you to believe something that maybe isn't true. A Google search this week of less than expected yielded the following headlines. Employment gains in July were less than expected. U.S. import prices rise less than expected. API data show less than expected crude supply fall. Nordstrom sales rise less than expected. Forecasts cut. And of course, this perception management strategy is used globally, with headlines that read, Eurozone retail sales fall, but less than expected. Peruvian GDP falls less than expected. You get the point. The battle for our mind is everywhere. The battle to persuade and manipulate our beliefs is rampant. An illustration put out by the Frugal Dad website showed the history of media consolidation from 1983 to 2011. In 1983, 90% of the U.S. media was controlled by 50 companies. In 2011, 90% of the U.S. media was controlled by 6 companies. In other words, 232 media executives control the information diet of 277 million Americans. I would say each of them fully understands the psychology of phrases such as less than expected and countless others. Think critically. Ask questions. When in doubt, speak up. As the economy destabilizes even further, and the often repeated mantra of a recovering economy becomes transparent, thin, and ultimately tears, the very fabric of society is going to tear right along with it. The pain, setbacks, and personal defeats that many people have isolated themselves with are going to become visibly apparent to others. And when more people realize that more people are suffering just like them, despite outward appearances, a tremendous betrayal of trust in our media and elected officials can emerge literally overnight. That will likely be the same day when a betrayal of trust and confidence in paper currencies the world over begins to unfold. That is the day you are preparing for. Forget the gyrations and mammoth volatility in gold and silver, as those will take care of themselves. And on the day true confidence is lost, gold and silver will never look back. And by the next day, the greatest generational transfer of wealth from all things paper to all things tangible will have occurred. And the world will never be the same again in our lifetimes. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.